and statistics, but David told me there was a question in the problem session, and I'm sorry I didn't make it to the problem session, but my mean free path is rather short, and probability of scattering is very, very high, and so let me just talk a little bit about that. Two of the equations for cold dark matter, both of the equations, sorry, we had three equations, right, for delta, theta, and delta H. And there were no derivatives anywhere, okay? And I was arguing, basically, you can understand all the properties of these equations just from the homogeneous Friedman equation, spatially homogeneous Friedman equation. How does that work? You know, you're perturbing the universe, but locally it just looks like a Friedman universe. And so let me now actually quantitatively derive the growth of perturbations just from the homogeneous Friedman universe to show you exactly how it works. Okay, so these long wavelength perturbations, which is you have a very long wavelength perturbation, if the Hubble radius, or alternatively you can think the distance light has traveled since the singularity, if that distance is shorter than the wavelength of the wave, then the wave doesn't really know it's a wave, hasn't started to oscillate, nothing's happened. And so locally it's just like a piece of homogeneous Friedman universe. And basically there's nothing to stop you comparing one piece with another piece, and one of the pieces can be perturbed relative to the second piece, and you can calculate how the perturbations grow. So let me, derivation of the adiabatic growing and decaying modes from the Friedman equation. Okay, so I claim you can actually understand those growing and decaying modes just from the Friedman equation. Okay? The adiabatic ones. Adiabatic, because remember, definition of adiabatic is that locally the matter, radiation, dark matter is just following some curves which are fixed. They're in fixed ratio. And so basically when you perturb the universe, all you're doing is shifting it up or down those curves as far as the matter content goes. So you see we had these curves, density versus scale factor, and say we have cold dark matter, we have radiation, we have cold dark matter, and at any point in the universe, I'll be somewhere on this curve, okay? And so if I tell you the density of the dark matter, from this curve, you can predict what the density of the photons are. Now, adiabatic means that even in the presence of perturbations on long wavelengths, that's still true. That if I tell you the density of the cold dark matter, you can say, aha, that's the A, and that must be the photons. So you can't tell, in a sense, you can't tell you're perturbed, okay, by measuring locally, by measuring the matter properties locally. There's one way you can tell you're perturbed, and that is by measuring the spatial curvature. And that tells you if you're perturbed. So let's just do this derivation. And I'm now going to work in proper time. So just as a warning, this is n naught equals 1. Okay, and in proper time, the scale factor for a radiation-dominated universe goes like t to the 1/2. And the scale factor for a matter-dominated universe goes like t to the 2/3. Okay, so remember, in proper time, we have a dot over a squared is 8 pi g over 3 rho. Rho goes like 1 over a to the 4th in a radiation-dominated universe. So rdu, this gives us a dot proportional to a to the minus 2, because I get two factors from a here. So a dot goes like a inverse, and that gives a goes like t to the 1/2. Matter-dominated universe, a dot is proportional 1 over a cubed times a squared gives A inverse, take the square root, it's A to the minus 1/2, and so A goes like T to the 2/3. Okay, so I'm going to use proper time everywhere, just makes it a little bit easier. And then write out the Friedman equation. That's just A dot squared is 8 pi g over 3 rho A squared minus k. Okay, because I had the 1 over A squared. I had k over A squared. I've multiplied through by A squared. That's why I do it in proper time, actually. I don't want any time dependence coming in that term. It just messes things up a little bit. Okay, so now differentiate this equation. D by dt of this equation. The left-hand side gives me 2 a double dot a dot. And the right-hand side, well, rho is a function of a. Okay, it's some, rho is just a function of a. Okay, it's rho follows this curve. And for rho total, I would add up these two curves. But it's always just a function of A. So when I differentiate this, what I get is the partial, is the derivative, d by dA, of this thing, okay, times A dot. Okay, so this is a nice little identity. I can cancel A dots. And that 2A double dot is the derivative, d by dA, of that quantity, 8 pi g over 3 rho a squared. Okay, so I'll use that identity in a second. Now, let's take this equation, and we want to perturb it. Okay, so how do I perturb it? I just say a is equal to a, let's call that maybe a naught, the background scale factor, times 1 plus alpha. So I'm considering some trajectory for a, which is slightly perturbed from the background one. Okay, that's the fractional perturbation in the scale factor. And then also, I'm going to perturb this guy. That's the spatial curvature. So I can say k is k naught plus delta k. Just a constant. So what am I really doing? I'm considering a trajectory that is slightly different than the background one. I'm considering a spatial curvature that's slightly different than the background one. So, for example, the background curvature might be 0, but when I perturb the universe, I might have a slightly closed universe or a slightly open universe. Okay, I'm allowed to do that. They're both legitimate solutions of the Einstein equations and everything. Okay, so if I work this out, then of course A dot here is A naught dot 1 plus alpha plus A naught alpha dot. Okay, and so now I will substitute in the Friedman equation. And the left-hand side, well, obviously I get A naught dot squared, zeroth order. And right-hand side, I'll have zeroth order value of this quantity and zeroth order of that, and they must be zero. They must equal, because that's the background. So ignore the background part. It has to be satisfied by definition of the background. Let's look at first order in the perturbations. Okay, so I put this into there, and what I get is a naught dot squared. From squaring this guy, I will get a 2 alpha. Right, so this is at first order in the perturbations. So from this one squared, I get the 2 alpha. And then I'll get this cross term, plus a naught dot factor of 2 a naught alpha dot. Okay, and then on the right-hand side of the Friedman equations, I've got to perturb this 8 pi g over 3 rho a squared. But perturbing that is just differentiating it with respect to a, right, and multiplying it by delta a, which is a naught alpha. But I know what the derivative of it is. It's just 2 a double dot. So that will be 2 a naught double dot So this here is d by dA of 8 pi g over 3 rho a squared, evaluated on the background. It's just 2a naught double dot times delta a, but delta a is just a naught alpha. Okay, and then I have the perturbation to the curvature, which is delta k. So that's the Friedmann equation at first order. And so now I will I just reorganize this equation. So it's a first order differential equation for alpha. Alpha dot from here, so divide by 2 a naught dot a naught. Okay? So this gives me alpha dot plus a naught dot over a naught alpha. That's the left-hand side. Actually, I should bring this term over there. So divide by 2 a naught dot gives me minus a naught double dot over a naught dot alpha. And then on the right-hand side, I get minus delta k over 2 a naught dot. Yep. Oh, we're starting from this equation, okay? And we are making this substitution. I'm just substituting for a background value, which is a solution of this equation with k equals k naught. And so I just substitute these two formulas into here, ignore the zeroth order piece, because that's a solution, and look at the first order in alpha. Now, so on the left-hand side, I've worked out what it is to first order. On the right-hand side, I've got to consider this function. As I said, it's a function of a, but I want to perturb it around a naught. So I evaluate the derivative of this function at a naught, and I multiply it by delta a. So the derivative of it, which I proved here, derivative of with respect to a, is just 2a double dot. And then I multiplied by the perturbation in A, which is A naught alpha. So it's 2 A naught double dot A naught alpha. Yeah.
It seems like normally in cosmology, people either like K be 0 plus 1 or minus 1.
Yeah. So that's a very good question. What is delta K? So the when you choose K to be 1 or minus 1, that is a choice of units. So if you think what is K, actually, you work out the curvature of the universe, okay? It's K over A squared. I think there's a 6 in here. Okay, so the Ricci scalar of the universe is 6K over A squared. Now, a choice of, basically by rescaling A, the scale factor, I can absorb anything in K, I can make K 1 or minus 1, okay? But that's just a particular choice of A. And so it's a convenience, but you don't have to do it. And for this purpose, it's actually a stupid thing to do. It's like saying I had a universe which had a curvature of 0, and then I bend it a little bit, and it has a tiny little bit of curvature, but I'm going to set it equal to 1. Well, then you know, your whole perturbation expansion, the curvature, is going to be a disaster. So don't do that. So don't rescale it. Okay. So I think what I would say is never do that rescaling. Maybe at the end of the calculation you can do it if you want to make something pretty. But actually, there's a physical quantity, which is the radius of curvature. So this is equal to, I guess it's 6 over the radius of curvature of the universe. So if you have a sphere, you know, with some radius of curvature, the Ricci scalar is the inverse squared radius of curvature. There's some number here. I'm not sure it's 6. And if it's a negatively curved space, it will be like a saddle, but with some radius of curvature. So there's a definite physical quantity there, and you're perfectly legitimate to do a perturbation of that. quantity, but don't rescale it to 1. Okay, so I've derived this equation for alpha. And it turns out you can solve this exactly. It's a first-order differential equation, so there's one integration constant, and this is a second constant. Okay, so the general solution I can write out, and it turns out it's this. You can just check that. That's the solution of the homogeneous equation. And the inhomogeneous solution, which solves the equation with this source, is delta k over 2 a naught dot over a naught integral dt 1 over a naught dot squared up to time t. Okay, so that's the general solution. Now, I claim that displays both the growing and decaying modes, adiabatic growing and decaying modes, for example, for a cold dark matter universe. And let's just check that. So e.g., a cold dark matter universe. So in a cold dark matter universe, A naught, or matter-dominated universe, A goes like t to the 2/3. And that's proportional to the conformal time squared. Okay, so that's conformal. The relationship between physical and conformal is dt is A of t, A of t dt conformal. So t conformal time is integral dt over A of t. If A of t goes like t to the 2/3, conformal time goes like t to the 1/3. So the scale factor in a matter-dominated universe goes to physical time to the 2/3, or conformal time squared. Let's work this out in physical time. So alpha is c, a dot over a is 2 over 3t. Okay, that's physical time. And this of course, is proportional to conformal time to the minus 3. And if you remember when we solved the equation for delta in a CDM universe, the decaying mode was conformal time to the minus 3. So here it is. And basically, this tells you exactly what that decaying mode is. It's just a shift in time. See, if I take the Friedman equations, they are time translation invariant. Okay. And if I shift the time in the universe, or the time of the Big Bang, so I have these two trajectories. I've got t to the 2/3, looks something like this, right? If I just shift it, that's still a solution of the Friedman equation, okay? And I can just work out the difference between those two curves. And in fact, all this is saying is that the shift in the scale factor A, which is A naught alpha, is just A naught dot. If you time translate something, you just shift it by the derivative. So that's the decaying mode. It's rather a trivial thing. It's just a shift in the time since the Big Bang. The growing mode is more interesting. So let's do this integral. So if a naught goes like t to the 2/3, then this integral goes like delta k. I won't keep track of the numerical factors. You can do that. A dot over A is 2 over 3t. Well, I said I wouldn't, so let me just do 1 over t. A naught dot over A naught is 2 over 3t. And then integral dt, A naught dot is t to the minus 1/3. And so divide by A naught dot squared, I've got a t naught to the minus 2/3 on the bottom. Bring it to the top, t to the 2/3 on top, do the integral. I get t to the 5/3. And what do you know? That's equal to delta k t to the 2/3. And t to the 2/3 is tau squared. So that's the growing mode we had before. Okay, so in this way, you see that it's really the curvature perturbation which gives you the growing mode. And you can, if you like, you can just repeat this algebra in a radiation-dominated universe. everything I did is absolutely correct, even if I have a radiation-dominated universe. And what you'll find, radiation-dominated universe, we'll find the growing mode goes like tau squared, goes like t. Proper, sorry, goes like conformal time squared, goes like proper time. Okay, well, why did we work so hard to work these things out if they're really rather trivial? Okay. And the reason is, of course, that we really want those spatial gradients. And the spatial gradients will tell us exactly how things behave on shorter distances as you, as the universe expands. So all of this is only valid if the wavelength of perturbation is really very large, much bigger than the Hubble radius, at the time you're looking at it. Okay, are there any questions about that? Okay, so let me go back to what I was doing yesterday, that we had this idea that we would take the universe and perturb the density. Okay, so I guess in Bardeen's notation, delta x is the fractional perturbation of the energy density. All right, so the picture is that as a function of x, if I graph the fractional density perturbation, if I graph the energy density, let's call it E, the total energy density, there's some average level, which is E naught, and then there's this fluctuation epsilon. And the whole business of perturbation theory is to figure out how that epsilon evolves with time. Okay, so I'm going to deal with this quantity, the fractional density perturbation, so it's dimensionless. It's a dimensionless quantity, and makes sense to say delta is, for example, one part in 100,000. If the energy density is perturbed by one part in 100,000, then you say delta is 100,000. So in the universe we live in, delta is approximately 10 to the minus 5 at early times. Okay, how do we know that? We just look at the sky. We just look at the cosmic microwave sky. Temperature is 2.7 degrees Kelvin. You look at the fluctuations in the temperature, and they're about 30 microkelvin. They're about one part in 100,000 of the temperature. Okay, so we know the fractional perturbation to the density of the universe, to the temperature of the universe, and the density of the universe are about one part in 100,000. That means linear perturbation theory is really good. Okay, because linear perturbation theory, you're expanding in delta. So the second order effects you can immediately see are going to be 10 to the minus 10. They're very small. So linear theory is a good. Linear theory is great. Okay, so the universe was designed so that we could do perturbation theory, and it would be very accurate. So let me say a little bit more about this. Any theory, we don't actually predict what the structure will be, right? Inflation doesn't tell us that the Milky Way is going to form or that the Virgo cluster or something. We only get the theories give statistical predictions. Statistical predictions. Okay, they just tell us that if, for example, they can predict the two-point correlation function. So, sorry, I should say. So theory gives statistical predictions. One of the prediction from a sensible theory will be the mean perturbation. So basically, you've got to have some mechanism to make the background. Okay, there was a big bang. There was a singularity. You've got to have some physics that generates all the radiation and matter. Or at the end of inflation, the inflating field will decay into energy, into radiation and matter. But then you've also got to have some mechanism for producing these fluctuations. And the mechanisms for doing that will give you zero mean for fluctuation at any point. And they will give you a two-point function. Usually called psi. Okay? And the two-point function is only a function of the difference in spatial locations because of translation invariance. Okay, so translation invariance says that if I shift x by a constant and y by the same constant, the correlation function shouldn't change. And so now, as I mentioned, it's convenient to go to Fourier space, to Fourier transform, because that turns the grad squareds in the perturbation equations into k squared, minus k squared. And so then you just have ordinary differential equations to solve. And so in particular, we write delta of x is a sum of Fourier modes e to the ik dot x delta sub k. These are the amplitudes of each Fourier mode. And I work in a box of volume V with periodic boundary conditions. And then, as I described last time, the sum can usually be approximated as an integral d3k over 2 pi cubed times V. The reason I like to do this, and many people like to do this, is because the dimensions of everything stay the same. Okay, so you see, if this is dimensionless, delta k is also dimensionless. There's no dimension anywhere. If I turned this into an integral and threw away the volume, okay, then it wouldn't be dimensionless anymore. So the dimensionless of your Fourier modes would have to compensate for this d3k. So in many books, you'll find people don't have the volume. And I think, and then you'll find dimensional analysis doesn't work in any of their formulae. And so I don't like doing things that way. It's, I prefer to, because it's a really good check of your calculation to make sure that the dimensions are correct. And I prefer to leave the volume in always. Okay, even in quantum field theory, I like to leave the volume in, and then you can really check line by line, everything is dimensionally correct. You'll find most of the formulae in quantum field theory books, if you check the dimensions, don't actually make sense. Okay. At intermediate steps. that's sort of true. When people derive scattering cross sections and stuff like that, they don't usually put in the dimensions. Okay, anyway, so this is a convenient way to do things. Now, of course, I can invert this formula. This formula implies that I can integrate this over the volume. So this implies that d3x over volume e to the minus ik dot x times delta of x. Okay? Again, you've got to have that volume there, so this has the same dimensions as that. And all I'm doing here is using the fact that these quantities are orthogonal for different k's. And so now if we calculate expectation value of delta k prime, using this, okay, so clearly I'm going to get an x integral times delta x for the first guy, and say a y integral times delta y for the second guy. And so let's just write that schematically like this, e to the minus I k dot x minus I k prime dot y. And then I will have my expectation value of delta x delta y. Okay, so I want to do this integral. Now, what I know is this is only a function of x minus y by translation invariance. And so what you do here, it's a standard manipulation, is you say, let x equal to y plus delta. Okay, so delta is the displacement of x from y. Okay, so I'm doing my three-dimensional x integral. I do that integral first, and all I do is I shift my integration variable is delta. So I just shift it by y, treat that as a constant in the x integral. Okay, and then this becomes an integral d3 delta over volume. This is now only a function of delta. Here I get a delta psi of delta. Okay, and I can pull these out of the y integral because all the only y dependence which remains is this one, is this. First, I get some y dependence from that, and then I have this one. So it's either minus k plus k prime dot y. Okay, so when you do this, the integral factorizes into two integrals. This integral is just a delta function. Okay, so this is just delta k plus k prime 0. I mean, this is 0 unless k is minus k prime. And if k is minus k prime, then it's 1. Because it's just integral d3y over the volume. What is this? This is just the Fourier transform of the correlation function. Okay, of the two-point correlation function. Now, this correlation function, if I've assumed spatial homogeneity here, if I assume isotropy, then the correlation function is really only a function of the magnitude of delta, right? Because it doesn't matter which direction delta is in. The correlation function really only depends on its magnitude. And if that's the case, then this integral only depends on the magnitude of k. And so basically, this is the definition of the power spectrum mod k, and I have this times the delta function. Okay, so that was the formula I gave you last time. But you see in this derivation a nice feature, which is that the power spectrum is the correlation function of the Fourier transform of the two-point correlation. Okay, so we see from this that the power spectrum of K equals expectation value of modulus delta k squared, because delta of minus k this tells you k prime must be minus k, but delta of minus k is delta of k star in reality of delta of x. Okay, so all from this point of view, all a theory, if you have a theory of some physical mechanism which does not break the, so you've got some FRW background, right, which is spatially homogeneous. You got it from somewhere. And then you've got some physical mechanism that throws down inhomogeneities. But you want the mechanism not to destroy. The mechanism is a random mechanism, which is statistically homogeneous in space. So it doesn't break the, it gives you an ensemble of perturbations, and the ensemble is homogeneous and isotropic. So each particular realization of that ensemble breaks the symmetry. Each particular, it's like, good analogy is if I had a bar of uranium, okay, which is unstable. And the bar is absolutely a perfect crystal of uranium. Okay, but the uranium atoms are quantum mechanically unstable to decay, and they will decay at random at some time. So if I look at this bar at a later time, I'll find patches of lighter nuclei sitting in the bar where they've decayed. And as time goes on, the patchiness will grow. It'll become more and more inhomogeneous. But that's an example of a statistically homogeneous process, which and each member of the ensemble will be inhomogeneous in space. So that's exactly the way that quantum fluctuations in inflation, or in the ekpyrotic universe, or most of the, or from, or inhomogeneities from phase transitions, they all have this property that they are a statistically homogeneous ensemble. The correlation function is translation invariant. And that seems to fit the universe very well. Okay? So in the universe, there's still controversy about this, but it seems the data fit pretty well with the assumption of statistical homogeneity. In other words, we live in a special place. There's a Milky Way, there's a local group of galaxies, and so on and so forth. But if you look at many volumes of the universe, and you average the initial density perturbation, then the data are consistent with that average being zero. In other words, with the mean density of the universe being the same from place to place. Okay, so now I want to define a very important concept, which is scale invariance. And the way scale invariance, the way we use scale invariance in cosmology is the most naive way. It's called engineering scaling dimension. The kind of ultimate insult a physicist can make to something, if it's really trivial, they call it engineering. Okay? So when you say something has engineering dimensions, it means like if you're really, really dumb and stupid, that's its dimension. Okay? But as you know, when you do renormalization, what's the naive dimension is not the correct dimension. Okay? There's renormalization, and there are anomalous scaling coefficients and all that. So this scale invariance used by cosmologists is engineering. It's the really dumb and naive version of scale invariance. Okay, scale invariance more generally refers to power law correlations and power law power spectra. But engineering version of scale invariance says if something has a dimension zero, if delta has dimension zero, it's dimensionless, right? Then when I write down when I write down its power spectrum, there should be no scale. Okay, so engineering means that
Okay, let me...
Yeah. So, engineering dimensions. First of all, I'm going to need one equation, which is the expectation value of delta squared of x. So that means the variance of delta at one point. You know, how much does this thing vary? It should be independent of whichever point I take, because this whole ensemble is homogeneous. But so let's just ask, what is the variance in this density field? And that's easy to write down, because that's the two-point correlation function at zero separation. And that's just the volume integral d3k times the power spectrum. Okay, so here I derived that the power spectrum is the Fourier transform of the correlation function. It's also true, just invert the Fourier transform, the correlation function is the Fourier transform of the power spectrum. d3k over, volume d3k times e to the I k dot delta times p of k. And this quantity is the correlation function at zero separation, so it's just the integral of the power spectrum. So to get the variance at a point, you've just got to integrate over everything, all the Fourier modes that you have. Every one of them contributes to the variance at a point. Now, this thing, what should we require of this? Well, that's dimensionless. Delta is dimensionless, okay? If there's no other, so if delta is dimensionless, then no other scale can happen in, can come in here. Now, the result has to be independent of V, because V is a completely artificial thing. So this power spectrum has to go like 1 over V, okay? But the power spectrum is dimensionless. It's got to go like 1 over V, because the answer has to be independent of V. But it's got to be dimensionless, so it's got to go like 1 over K cubed, because K cubed V is dimensionless. And so that means it's integral d3k over k cubed. And that means equal, I can work out that integral, that goes like integral k squared dk over k cubed, which is integral dk over k. And so that is log divergent in the UV and IR. And so all it means is that equal contributions to the variance from each logarithmic interval in K. Logarithmic interval. Okay, that integral goes like integral d of log k. So if I take k and then I take 2k and do the integral, I get log 2. If I take 2k and 4k, I get log 2. 4k and 8k. So every logarithmic interval of k contributes equally to delta. So some quantities in, when we come to do cosmology, this is worth kind of keeping in mind. And we will have to decide what, if we're interested in the scale invariant power spectrum, what quantity should have a scale invariant power spectrum. Now, in fact, it won't turn out to be delta. I should have... So let's just take this to be generic delta, okay? Because it'll turn out that the thing that this is not necessarily epsilon of x over e. And it'll turn out that the thing in cosmology which is scale invariant is in fact not this quantity, because there's another time that comes into the, there's another scale which enters in this quantity. The thing that, that is dimensionless turns out to be the gravitational potential. And that's related to this delta by a factor of k squared. So I'll get to that in a second. So before we do that, let me now talk about something a little bit more intuitive. The mass fluctuation in, yeah, let me see, I'm just getting... Yeah. Let me talk about the mean. The mean of delta in some volume. What do I call it? In some volume. I don't want to use the 4 pi over 3 r. Well, let me just leave it like this. I'll draw a sketch. So we've got this random field. Imagine that this pattern on the board of chalk is really my random field. And now the idea is that I throw down a sphere of radius r, and I can ask what is the value of delta averaged in that sphere? Okay, so that is integral d3x from 0 to r, so I've got to integrate over this volume, divide by 4 pi over 3 r cubed. And I just integrate delta. But delta, of course, is just the sum of a k e to the I. Sorry, delta k e to the minus I k dot x. Put those primes just to show they're integrated over. And actually, so I've put the ball centered on the origin now, but I could actually center it anywhere. So let me do that. So that would be x naught plus x prime. So here's my origin. I've thrown down a ball at position at x naught, and I integrate delta over that volume, and then I divide by the volume. So that's the mean fluctuation in that volume, in the volume that I've drawn. So that's a very sort of physical thing. I mean, you throw down a ball and you just measure what's the average of delta in that ball. So for this quantity, and I think I'll just leave this as an exercise, you can compute delta squared. Okay. And delta squared is going to be volume integral d3k p of k times a window function, which depends on the radius. And this window function depends on k times r, and that is equal to 3 sine kr minus kr cos kr over kr cubed all squared. Okay, so it looks a bit of a nightmare, but it's really not a difficult integral. Okay, you've got to do a 3D integral of this etik dot x. Just choose spherical polar coordinates and do the angular integrals first, and you'll end up with this. This window function, if you graph it, if you look at k. So it's a function of k. let me think. Sorry, no, it's a, I want to think about it as a, yeah, as a function of k, because I'm integrating over it with respect to k. So at small k, if you take the limit of small k, you'll find this window function is just 1. But if I go to large k, it falls off like kr to the minus 4. So what's going on? It's telling you that approximately delta bar squared is approximately given by this integral times a window function, which is 1 at small k and essentially 0 at large k. Okay, so providing this integral converges, and you have to check that, that the integral makes sense, and that happens for some range of behavior of p of k, providing that makes sense, then essentially the answer here is k cubed integral d3k just gives me k cubed p of k evaluated at k equals 1 over r. Okay, so the mean, the variance of this mean of delta in some volume of size r is just given by the power spectrum times k cubed evaluated at k equals 1 over r. So the assumption here is that this power spectrum will be a, will not be a, will be a smooth function, okay, so that when I do this integral over w, essentially, this is k squared dk times w. So I've got some integral that is k squared dk because w is flat. And so this grows with k. And just to ask, where is the integral going to be dominated? It will be dominated when k is of order 1 over r. And so I just need to know the value of the power spectrum at 1 over r. This is a very approximate formula, but it's not... it usually works pretty well. Up to numerical factors, it's reasonable. And so what you see is that delta bar squared goes like r to the minus 3 plus n if p of k goes like k to the n. And the integral converges if n is between minus 3 and 1. So that's another a sort of way of thinking about the meaning of the power spectrum. That if you throw down a ball of size r, and ask what it's the mean fluctuation of delta in the ball, it will scale as some power of r if the power spectrum is a power law in k. Okay. Okay, so now we are going to get to the famous Harrison-Peebles Zeldovich power spectrum. So these are three famous cosmologists working in the late 60s, early 70s, and the measurements were made of the distribution of galaxies, and they wanted to ask, what's a reasonable power spectrum for the mass density in the universe? What would make sense? Okay? And the argument's actually extremely simple. So what P of K is should we expect? So the first argument is that if there's no special scale, if it's something simple, right, some simple process, there should be no scale. And so it should be a power law. Okay, no special scale. Which power law? Okay, and so this amounts to saying what quantity do we know of in the universe that should be well defined at small scales and at large scales? Well, we look at the universe. It doesn't look very violent on small scales, right? We're not dominated by black holes. Galaxies are condensed objects, but they're not black holes. And so the gravitational potential is modest. Okay? So let's look at small scales. Okay? What is the gravitational potential? Phi. Well, phi is just gm over r, which is gm over r, which is v squared from the virial theorem, if you look at a cluster of galaxies. And so they knew what the typical velocity of the galaxies were, a few hundred kilometers per second. So take v squared, and you'll get about 10 to the minus 5. V squared over c squared. Okay, so phi in the right units, the dimensionless thing is this. Okay, dimensionless gravitational potential is v squared over c squared, which is about 10 to the minus 5. So on the small scales of the universe, this gravitational potential is not doing anything violent. It's nowhere near black holes, typically. And then on large scales, okay, they already knew that the temperature anisotropy was small. I mean, the CMB temperature was measured, right? And very crudely, like with a 10% error bar, but they knew the temperature is the same in different directions. So, and on large scales, you can measure the mass distribution. It looks pretty much the same. And so they also knew that phi is small on large scales. So your first guess is that maybe phi is the same on all scales. Right, the power spectrum of phi is the same on all scales. Small on small scales, small on large scales. And the power, so the first guess is that phi k so phi k squared, right, would be some number over the volume times k cubed. So it's a dimensionless quantity and equal to this number. This number will be about 10 to the minus 10. Okay, so that would be your naive guess. Now, that's exactly right. That's how the universe works. Okay. And they guessed this in the late 60s, early 70s. Okay, you don't need inflation or anything. It's a sort of very obvious guess to make. And that's called the Harrison-Peebles-Zeldovich spectrum. It's not explained this way. They derived it in a much more complicated way, but it's equivalent to this. The number is about 10 to the minus 10. You can see, so from what I did here, you can say if I take a ball of different sizes and put it in the universe and ask how much does the mass vary from place to place, how much does the mass vary on that scale, then we would call that phi bar squared. Just do that calculation. And you see it's k cubed times v, so it's just this number. So what it's saying is that this gravitational potential, the mean gravitational potential squared, the variance of the gravitational potential in a ball of any size will give that number. Okay, And that's really what I was using here. I was taking a ball the size of a cluster of galaxies and asking what's the gravitational, what's the variance of a gravitational potential. There's a kind of slight cheat in this argument, which is, it's not really a cheat, but it's the fact that when perturbations grow in the universe, so remember delta grows like T squared when stuff collapses, when matter self-gravitates, the delta grows like T squared. It turns out the gravitational potential does not grow, okay? And so basically whatever it was primordially, it is today. So that's why I can actually ignore the growth of the perturbations. The growth of the perturbations in a first approximation doesn't affect the gravitational potential. I can show that from this equation. It actually follows from Poisson's equation that d squared over a squared phi is equal to 4 pi g delta rho. Okay, that's Newton's equation for the gravitational potential, Poisson's equation for the gravitational potential, if that's the density. Now, delta rho over rho times rho. And if we put the a squared over there, what we showed is that delta rho over rho grows like a. So this goes like a. In a matter-dominated universe, that goes like 1 over a cubed. And so all these a's cancel. So actually, grad squared phi is equal to delta, and that's independent of time. Sorry, this is what we call delta. So grad squared phi is delta over a, proportional to delta over a, and it's independent of time. So this argument is basically correct. You also see from this that delta is proportional to k squared phi.
Running out of time. So the power spectrum of delta. Goes like K for Harrison-Peebles-Zeldovich. You see, phi squared goes like 1 over k cubed, but delta goes like this. You get k squared squared, k to the fourth divided by k cubed, so delta squared goes like k in the Harrison-Peebles-Zeldovich spectrum. So when you see graphs in the literature, so this is probably the most common graph in cosmology. You draw the power spectrum as measured from observations against K. And this power spectrum that's plotted is usually the power spectrum of delta, the density perturbation. So there's this, it's not of phi. And basically that goes like K. Okay, so that's the primordial power spectrum. Delta, you'll remember, so let's, that's right. Delta is not time independent, right? Delta is time dependent. Delta grows like A in a matter-dominated universe. And in fact, in either matter or radiation, it grows like conformal time squared. We worked that out in the previous lectures. So this curve is actually proportional to conformal time squared. This is now conformal time. Let me just note that. So delta k squared as a function of k goes like t, but it actually goes like t to the fourth, because delta goes like t squared. Every mode is growing like t squared. So this is conformal time. So actually, the argument Harrison, Peebles, and Zeldovich gave for this formula was the following, not quite the same as my argument. They said, let us consider the mass fluctuation, delta bar, inside a volume equal to the horizon, which is just t, at any time. And they wanted that to be the same, but to be independent of time. Okay, so you pick a volume whose radius is t, you work out delta bar squared in that volume. That's given by k cubed. We just worked that out. K cubed p of p delta of k at the time t. So that goes like k for t4. But I'm choosing at horizon crossing. So I've got some mode, wave number k, and that mode crosses the horizon when kt equals 1. So this is constant at horizon crossing. Okay, kt equals 1 is when the, so k is 2 pi over lambda. T over lambda equals 1 is when t equals lambda. And that's when the mode crosses the horizon. So they were arguing that this is the right spectrum, because if I get the mean mass fluctuations in a horizon volume at horizon crossing, it should be independent of time. And that's how they got this number k. Okay, so down here in this curve, we have kt to the fourth. And in the previous lectures, I showed you that whether you're in the matter era or the radiation era, on long wavelengths, delta grows like t squared. Okay, so this is the behavior in long wavelengths. As we go to shorter wavelengths, in fact, what happens is this bends. Shorter wavelengths, higher k, the true power spectrum bends over, and you've probably seen these curves for the power spectrum. I don't know if anyone's seen this in the literature. Okay, this is a very standard plot. In fact, I wanted to show you one. I don't have a projector, but let me just hold it up. If you read any review article on cosmology, they'll show you a curve like this, P of K, and it goes up and comes down, and then all the different models are different curves. This is an old graph, actually, so it shows the data lying bang on the CDM model, which is a model without a lambda, which is entirely a CDM universe, and it shows the lambda model ruled out. Okay, so this was the data from the early, about 1990. And nobody wanted this universe. So basically, they messed around with the data so that it fit the CDM model perfectly. That's one way of saying it. And so, again, this is a caution. In cosmology, sometimes people rule out models, and it's through various desires rather than actual conclusive proof. So the CDM model was the most popular model at that time, and the data went perfectly on the CDM model. Okay. Now, this curve, I have actually derived everything necessary to understand this decay here. I'll tell you what the answer is, that at k, this point here is k equal to 1 over t equality, the conformal time at equal matter radiation density. So k is smaller than that, we're outside the horizon at matter radiation equality. And so for these ones, these are long wavelength modes, the Harrison-Peebles-Zeldovich hasn't been changed. For modes which entered the horizon in the radiation era, there's some suppression. And the result here is k to the minus 3 log squared kt equality times t over t equality to the fourth. And you'll notice the log here. So we derive the fact that the perturbations in the CDM when we're in the radiation era only grow logarithmically. Okay, so instead of keeping up with this curve, basically what happens, so to get that formula, all I do is I say they were going like t to the fourth. Okay, that was the power spectrum. And then the mode crossed the horizon. Okay, now it crosses the horizon when t is 1 over k. So actually its value at that point was 1 over k cubed when t is 1 over k. That's when it crossed the horizon. Okay, now what happens to it? Well, it keeps growing, but only logarithmically. It grows like log t, it goes like log of t over the time of crossing. Time of crossing is 1 over, t over the time of crossing is kt. And it's squared, because this is a delta squared. And basically that's what it does in the radiation era. So I can follow this growth, log growth, all the way to the matter radiation equality. That becomes T equality. Okay? And that's the power spectrum at equality. After equality, it's in the matter era. So everything grows like T squared in the matter era. So now I get T over T equality squared, all squared, to the fourth. Okay, which is exactly this formula here. Okay, so this is this power spectrum basically fits the data very, very well. Okay, you take this power spectrum, you give it to somebody with an n-body simulation. They start off with little perturbations in their box. They run it forward, and they will find galaxies or lumps of matter that look like galaxies with roughly the right number of galaxies of given size, with roughly the right correlations between those galaxies. And this really works to high precision. Even though, as I mentioned, people do fiddle around with the data as well, so you should be somewhat suspicious. And we do not see the dark matter, okay? This is what we've calculated is the power spectrum of the dark matter. Well, we can't see it. So anything we infer about the spectrum is indirect. You've got to look at the galaxies. You have to assume the galaxies are tracing the dark matter in some way. And there are lots of uncertainties which enter. But qualitatively, this is correct. This feature, the big feature here, you see, is on a scale. If you work this out, what is 1 over t equality? It's some scale we can see today. It's about 25 megaparsecs. Okay, and when you look at the distribution of galaxies, you can see voids, you see features on a scale of around 25 megaparsecs. A thing called the Great Wall, there are various superclusters, they're roughly on that scale. Beyond that scale, at low k, it's looking more and more homogeneous. As we go to higher scales, this is the region where things go nonlinear. So in fact, you might say from the power spectrum it's falling off. So why do I see any galaxies here? But the reason is that this power, to work out delta bar squared, I've got to multiply the power spectrum by k cubed. All right? So that multiplication actually gets rid of that k to the minus 3. Now that gives me the mean fluctuation. So it actually grows logarithmically. So if we plot delta bar squared as a function of k, it's actually increasing like this all the way to high k. And so the level of linear density fluctuations is greatest on the smallest scales. And that's why we see more small galaxies than big galaxies in this picture. Okay, so I think that's all I want to do today. I'm not sure if I can't lecture tomorrow, but I might lecture Friday. You seem to have infinite stamina, so congratulations to you. So I think Param is going to talk a little bit about gauge issues tomorrow, and then I might talk finally about So here I've been very sketchy, and I haven't told you what's really gauge invariant and what isn't gauge invariant. This whole idea of a potential, what is this Newtonian potential? I mean, in synchronous gauge, you know, the TT component of the metric is one. There's no Newtonian potential there. So what is this guy? And I will try to deal with that on Friday. Are there any questions anybody has?
When we wrote the equation for delta, how do we know that this delta is a physical quantity? Because it's
not very it's not gauge invariant. Very good question. Okay. So gauge invariance is all to do with shifting your space-time slicing. Okay? So for example, it's kind of hard to draw this, but let's think of this as the time axis and this is the space axis. And let us plot the density. I guess I'm plotting it on the third axis. Okay? So I'm going to plot contours of constant density in space-time. So every space-time point, I can go and measure the density of the universe. And so these contours, you know, will look something like this. Okay? Whereas as I go down here, I am decreasing rho. So that's the very early universe, very, very dense, and the late universe is very dilute. Now, what is delta? Because I can pick slices, time slices, which are constant density slices. I can just choose the density to be the time, or one of the density to be the time or something, so that the late time is low density. Okay, so we can choose, we can set delta rho or epsilon equal to zero, right? By choosing rho equals constant slices. So delta zero. There are no density perturbations in the universe. Okay. So in fact, a rather famous cosmologist, a South African cosmologist, you might know him, I won't say his name, he actually wrote a paper claiming that the temperature anisotropies have to be zero. Okay, the so-called intrinsic temperature anisotropies, these are the ones where, because the density of the universe varies from place to place, you know, if I carve a sphere out in the universe at recombination. I'm looking back at the hot plasma when I look at the CMB. I'm seeing the universe as it was, and I see this temperature varying in different angles. And the kind of crude description of this is the temperature varies from place to place because the density varies from place to place. And so when I look out, I see different temperatures. So his point was, no, recombination happens at one temperature. That's when the electrons and protons combine. And so how can the temperature vary from place to place? So it's got to be exactly zero. Okay. And he was totally wrong. It's not zero. And the reason is whenever you pick a different slicing, the same physical effect will show up, but in something else. So by choosing this slicing, then all the physics is in gravity. Okay. Or you can choose some other slicing in which, you know, some of the, in which everything is here. So there's just this ambiguity about the slicing. And so what we'll discuss on Friday, and maybe Parham will discuss this tomorrow, is gauge invariant measures of the density variation. And so if you look at your Bardeen article, what he argues is there's essentially only one good one. It's not the one most people use, but he argues there's only one good one. And the other ones are okay, but they're very, they work in certain contexts. But there's one good one, and he calls it zeta. And it has a very, very physical interpretation. It's equal to phi. If you remember, phi was the conformal perturbation of the metric, right?
We had hij was a squared fij 1 plus 2 phi. Okay, this guy is the conformal perturbation of the metric. And then we had the other term, dj something else, gamma.
Okay. But the conformal metric perturbation is one thing. That's a nice quantity for several reasons, because this conformal kind of rescaling space, that's all this is doing. You have some metric and you just scale it up by a factor. It's very plausible that if you scale the metric up by some factor and evolve the universe, that factor won't change. And that's essentially his conserved quantity. But there's another way of saying it, which is that the three curvature is equal to, is basically, the perturbation in the three curvature is proportion, is basically box plus c over a squared. I think it's 3c over a squared phi. But the perturbation in the three curvature is proportional to phi. So if you think about the spatial curvature, phi is actually measuring the how the spatial curvatures change. It's the delta k. This would be the delta k in my crude derivation. Right, that would be delta k. So you take this phi, and then you combine it with the energy perturbation plus E naught. And that quantity turns out to be gauge invariant. Okay, that if I redefine my time or space coordinates by small perturbations, this doesn't change. So you can think about this as follows. Either think about it as the curvature perturbation, or the delta k, on the slices where epsilon is zero. Okay, that's a good slicing. Just choose to slice your universe so that epsilon is zero. Then this is the curvature perturbation. Or you can say, no, I'm going to choose to slice it on slices where this is zero. So I have a flat universe. It's unperturbed. The geometry is unperturbed. Then it's the density perturbation. Okay? But this quantity is gauge invariant. Invariant. And of course, and this quantity has the Harrison HPZ spectrum. So when I did my derivation using the arguing about the Newtonian potential, it's actually this that I'm talking about, and that this is fully, you know, covariant, gauge invariant, etc., etc. So I think we'll on Friday we'll discuss that a little bit more. So when you read the cosmological literature, you'll find a million different gauges, a million different quantities, conserved quantities, this and that, and so on. And they're all equivalent. And the only difference between them is everybody's choosing different slices here of space-time. Any physical result should not care about what slicing you choose. Okay. See you Friday.
Did you want to say something about the...